Well, it's wonderful to have the opportunity to talk with you after returning from a week of silent practice. I was in the Pacific Northwest in a beautiful location with the Red Cedar Zen community of Bellingham, Washington. So, what happens when you sit and walk in silence for several hours each day in community? First, you feel the support of the community, the silent presence of 50 people. As you sit together day after day, eat silent meals with them, chant, and do all the Zen rituals together. You get much more support for practice on retreat, sitting together, shoulder to shoulder. Then we can provide each other in a 45-minute silent sit on Zoom. And as I was sitting here today, I thought, and another thing is, if you're on the retreat and you don't feel like meditating, there's really nothing else to do. So there's nothing to call you away from the practice. And the stillness of the community helps contain the wild mind so that moments of calm and inner quiet can become more frequent and consistent. And you feel like you can be with what is more and more. What keeps people coming back to retreats each year? If we were motivated by the hope that this would make us enlightened beings, we would have stopped coming back long ago. I've never heard anyone leave a retreat saying that they felt enlightened. We practice together because it makes our lives better. It makes it easier for us to live with ourselves and for others to live with us, which is why people who attend retreats often say, "My partner doesn't meditate, but totally supports my coming here to practice because I'm a lot easier to live with when I return home." It is, of course, impossible to communicate the experience of silent practice in words, just as it is impossible to say the name of Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh or describe our personal experience of the interconnectedness of all being, the unfolding of reality, in words. In Torah, Moses represents a conduit between our everyday experience, in which we perceive ourselves as separate entities, and the universal perspective of Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, who sees the oneness of all creation. At the burning bush, Moses describes himself as being unable to speak clearly, being of uncircumcised lips, being unfit for the task he has been given to go back and speak to the Israelites and liberate them. As I reflected on this, I wondered whether Moses's speech impediment is a metaphor for his inability to describe in words his experience of connection with Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. Because it's impossible to communicate the essence of spiritual insight with words, most traditions use stories, dialogues, and commentaries to guide us on our own unique path of spiritual practice. Zen captures this challenge of putting truth into words with a few pithy phrases like, "Open your mouth and you're wrong," or, "Don't mistake the finger pointing at the moon for the moon." Spiritual teachings are only a finger pointing us in a particular direction. In Jewish tradition, we have the stories of Torah and Tanakh and the great commentaries, the debates and dialogues among the rabbis, extending over a few hundred years and ongoing in the present. In the Zen tradition, we have the sutras, the Buddhist scriptures, plus records of dialogues between student and teacher from centuries of practice in China and Japan. So this week's Torah reading, Parshat Korach, tells the story of Korach's rebellion against Moses and Aaron. While on retreat, I learned two Zen stories that address related questions, and so today I'll be able to give you some Zen commentary on the rebellious spirit and also on the question of what to do about the world when it is in a sorry state. First, a quick review of Korach's rebellion. Korach, a cousin of Moses and Aaron, betook himself and 200 leaders of the community to rise up against Moses and Aaron, saying, "You have gone too far, for all the community of are holy, all of them, and Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh is in their midst. Why do you raise yourself above Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh's congregation?" When Moses heard this, he fell on his face. Moses then responds by describing how Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh will make known who is holy, who truly represents Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. He declares, "By this you shall know that it was Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh who sent me to do all these things, that they're not of my own devising. If these people, the rebels' death, is that of all humankind, if it is their lot to have a humankind's common fate, it was not Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh who sent me. But if Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh brings about something unheard of, so that the ground opens its mouth and swallows them up with all that belongs to them, and they go down to Sheol, you know, shall know that those involved have spurned Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh." Scarcely had he finished speaking all these words when the ground under them, the rebels, burst asunder, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up with their households, all Korach's people and all their possessions. As if this was not punishment enough, right after, a fire went forth from Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh and consumed 250 others who had stood with Korach. And in response to this rebellion, two times Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh threatens to wipe out the whole community. And despite the community having turned against him, Moses pleads with Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh to spare the people. Even when the whole community rails against him and Aaron, Moses orders Aaron to make expiation for the people so that a plague that Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh sent can be stopped. And Aaron's actions check the plague, but only after 14,700 people beyond Korach and his comrades have perished. Quite a catastrophic punishment, especially for a rebellion that at first is articulated in a way that seems to reflect our modern day democratic values. Korach says, "You have gone too far, for all the community are holy, all of them, and Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh is in their midst. Why do you raise yourself above Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh's congregation?" Each time I hear these words, I think at first, well, the guy's got a point there. If Moses were a political leader, and if this were a political debate, indeed, Korach would have a good point. However, the message that runs through Torah is that Moses is not simply a political leader. He is the channel through which Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh becomes an active force in the world. To rebel against Moses is to fight against the order of the universe, against the truth of reality unfolding. And as we see, when we fight reality, we can't win. Nevertheless, I understand why Korach may relate to Moses as a political leader rather than as a spiritual leader, because in the story of Exodus from Egypt, Moses' role as prophet and political leader do get mixed together. Moses is not simply a spiritual leader who can offer the teachings that have been transmitted to him. Moses needs to convince the Israelites to give up their homes in Egypt, to abandon any sense of security and to flee into the desert, where water is scarce, food is unfamiliar, and the path is uncertain. Korok's rebellion also immediately follows the story of the scouts, in which the Israelites are outright told, "In this very wilderness, your carcasses will drop. Of all of you who were recorded in your various lists, from the age of 20 years up, you who have muttered against me, not one shall enter the land in which I swore to settle you, save Caleb and Joshua, but your carcasses will drop in the wilderness." When I read this, I had this moment of feeling, was that why they did all those censuses and lists so that God could do the accounting of who should die? That sounds terrible. So in this week's Torah reading, when the people rail against Moses and Aaron, repeating their complaint that they have been brought into the wilderness to die, they are not just kvetching, they're correct. That's not the only reason they were brought there, but they will die. Because, as it turns out, despite the ultimate good outcome for future generations, the promise that the next generation will enter the promised land, this generation did leave their life in Egypt to die in the wilderness. From the point of view of the Israelites, also, Moses, their leader, had been a stunning example of speaking truth to power, of standing up to the despotic rule of Pharaoh. So it must have been a disillusionment to discover that their fears and grumblings against their leader were being punished by death. And so it seems to me that we are better off when our spiritual leaders are not our political leaders. In other words, I see a lot of good reasons for the separation of church and state. So, do Zen stories have anything to teach us about our dissatisfaction with authority figures? Dissatisfaction, of course, can be more safely expressed when rebellion is not a matter of life and death, when acceptance or rejection of spiritual teaching is not a life and death decision that refugees must make. And fortunately for us, we have generally been able to choose a spiritual path freely, to follow or reject any spiritual leader based on our experience and judgment. For young Zen students sent to the monastery to learn at the feet of their masters, it was not such a free choice. However, a story from the Book of Serenity, a series of dialogues, describes an unusually open and devaluing attitude in a student and how it is dealt with by his teacher. The student, Ho, has the job of being the attendant for the master, Dishan, to wait on Dishan, to learn at his feet. The student asks his teacher, "Where have all the sages gone since antiquity?" Dishan said, What? How's that?" So this would be like saying to your most esteemed professor at Harvard, "What happened to all those smart Harvard professors? I thought they were, you know, I thought Harvard would produce something better than what I've got here." The teacher, however, acts as if he doesn't even hear the insult. However, rather than taking a hint and letting it pass, the student barrels ahead. The student said, "The order was for a flying dragon horse, but a lame tortoise shows up." Again, the teacher let it rest. The next day, When the teacher comes out of his bath, the student, his job is to, you know, hand him a towel, hand him some tea. So the student hands him some tea, and the teacher pats the student on the back. And the student says, "This old fellow has finally gotten a glimpse." And again, the teacher let the matter rest. Here we see the rebellious student persist in his arrogance, and the wise teacher responds with generosity, patting him on the back. The student, nevertheless, continues his demeaning refrain. And again, the teacher let the matter rest. This is a very different model of dealing with criticism, allowing the student to go through his developmental phase of arrogance and devaluing as the teacher remains confident in his teaching. Of course, this is a luxury that Moses does not have. As a political leader and warrior, he needs to rally the respect and obedience of the people so he can lead the next generation to the promised land. So I, like you perhaps, get to this point feeling more confused than enlightened, and most of all feeling relieved that my spiritual practice does not force me to choose between a secure home and dying in the wilderness so that the next generation can live with religious freedom. However, as I reflected on this, I thought, considering the destructive impact that our generation and previous ones have had on the earth and the climate, we do in fact have to leave behind certain comforts and conveniences in order for future generations to thrive. So since this brings us back to the question of our own troubled times, I'll end with another story from the Book of Serenity. This is about a teacher who farms at his monastery and a student who's been on a pilgrimage. The teacher says, "Where do you come from?" And the student answers, "From the south." The teacher asked, "How is Buddhism in the south these days?" The student responds, "There's extensive discussion." The teacher says, "How can that compare to me here, planting the fields and making rice to eat?" The student said, "What can you do about the world?" The teacher said, "What do you call world?" The teacher's answer draws our attention to the world that we can do something about. The world of the people immediately around us with whom we interact every day. To this world, we bring either the blessing or the curse of our state of mind in each moment. Whatever is going on in our mind will determine how we respond to the unfolding of reality in each moment, whether we greet others with disdain or compassion. Today, as in the time of these Zen stories, there is extensive discussion about what to do about the world. We debate and discuss, and of course we need to do that. But if these worries and discussions about the world take the place of our practice, of our attending to our own state of mind, in the world immediately around us, then we're neglecting the impact that we can have moment to moment on the world that is right here, right now.